So how is it that you became interested in Wittgenstein?
In a very strange way. At the very beginning of my studies, I was doing mathematics. I received a rather generous scholarship in Germany. And part of this scholarship requested all the newly elected ones to join in a long vacation on a topic. So you learned how to academic work did actually work. There was a general topic, and then groups were formed to discuss certain aspects of this general topic. At my day, it was Christianity or theology and atheism. And I joined the atheists because I expected it to be intellectually more rewarding. But I had to read a terrible book, that was the high price I paid, by Russell, Why I Am Not a Christian, an awful book. And in this book, which I would never under normal circumstances have read more than 10 pages, there was one or two quotes by a Wittgenstein of whom I had never heard. They were so wonderful, like precious stones in a whole lot of mud. And I thought, this Wittgenstein you must read. And that's how it all started.
When was this? What date?
That was in 1962, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But then I continued first doing mathematics. Mm. And after mathematics, I did a second degree in physics. And after physics, I did a third one in zoology. But in all my studies in sciences, my main interest was what one could call a poetic one, namely the underlying description of formal explanations. So you could say my view and aspect was more that of Faraday than of Maxwell, even though I'm a great admirer of Maxwell. Mm-hmm. And over all these years, I was reading more and more of Wittgenstein, and it became clear that the publications of his writings were full of mistakes. We had no access to the originals, but there were clear indications it could not have been like that. And I started a correspondence with one of the publishers, one of the editors, and one of the heirs of Wittgenstein, Rasch Ries. And he had to admit that wherever I pointed out to a possible mistake, that it was a mistake. So he developed a kind of trust. And eventually my friends, we had a circle reading Wittgenstein, had the idea, which was fashionable at the time, to produce a pirated edition. That was at the time when Wittgenstein's manuscripts had become available as a microfilm, the so-called Cornell film, which was in 1972. And I was not a great admirer of pirated editions, so I said, this has to be done seriously, and I will talk to Wittgenstein's heirs. That's how I came to Cambridge for the first time in 73. And the heirs said, yes, indeed, the editions which they have produced are problematic, should be done better, but they did not believe it could be done, as Wittgenstein's Nachlass, his writings, were so complicated. So I saw them 1 year later again in 74, and they agreed that I should do such an edition if I took responsibility. But I had a job in the Max Planck Society in Tübingen, and I didn't want to give up my work in zoology. So I said I would take on responsibility but continue my work as a scientist, and I started looking for funding, and then finally found rather generous funding from the Thyssen Foundation. But as soon as I had funding and the project started, something very strange happened, which I might have been able to foresee, but I didn't foresee it. Namely that my friends and colleagues who came not from sciences, but from philosophy and the humanities, all of a sudden turned from friends into foes. And that each one had a different idea how such an edition should look like. And their main interest of editing Wittgenstein was to use Wittgenstein as a sort of big ship onto which they could load their own ideas in form of footnotes. But I had agreed with Wittgenstein's heirs that we would produce a non-commented edition, so with no learned commentary. And eventually all my former friends and all the friendships fell apart, and I had to decide whether to give up the whole project of editing Wittgenstein or give up my work as a scientist. And I have chosen the latter. Whether that was wise or not, I do not know, but I am still convinced that Wittgenstein's writings are the most important of our time.
You said earlier that it had led to a lot of pain or frustration as well as a lot of pleasure. Are you referring to the loss of these friends, or are there other things which on the journey have become really stressful?
That I could and should have been able to see this beforehand. If I had looked at the secondary literature on Wittgenstein, then there was already a great deal. So Wittgenstein was the philosopher that philosophers studied, and they wrote about Wittgenstein. If I had read the secondary literature, I would have realized the bitchiness, the incompetence, the desire to become the true apostle of Wittgenstein. And that is actually something that started already at Wittgenstein's lifetime, that people stylized, presented themselves as the true apostles, presenting the true gospel. Wittgenstein hated it no end. And he said about such people, giving some names which I won't give now, he said, "They show you a stolen bunch of keys, but don't know what doors to open with." So that is probably the undercurrent of the difficulties I entered into by editing Wittgenstein. And the interesting thing is, as I do not myself produce any learned commentary, I would have thought they would leave me alone. But it seems that as I concentrate on what he has actually written and presenting his writings very precisely and truthfully, they show themselves as being cheats. And that does not make friends, no.
Cheats?
Yes, well, they say certain things about what Wittgenstein has said and meant, which is clearly wrong. So a great deal of the secondary literature are by people who present themselves as being the only ones having access to the true material. So people have to listen to them. It's a bit like in the old days when the scriptures were presented by an elite and a small group before Protestantism.
Were the originals in German?
Wittgenstein wrote almost all his philosophy in German.
So the fact that you were German and spoke, were you Austrian, are you?
Well, I come from a very strange part of Germany which had all sorts of ownerships. It was even once part of Hungary, but is now part of Germany. Mm-hmm.
But you spoke German as your native language.
German is not my mother tongue, but I learned it at the age of 4 when I was sent to school. Mm. And I immediately fell in love with the German language.
What's your mother tongue?
My love tongue. My mother tongue is an ancient Slavonic language called Sorbisch or Wendisch. Hmm. Very strange, very ancient old language with as old languages have it, a very small vocabulary, but a very, very complex, rich set of forms. So it's basically a poetic language. Hmm.
So do you think the fact that you came to love German gave you an advantage over a lot of the scholars, though I suppose many of them were also German philosophers, but many of them were British philosophers who'd had to rely on translations?
Yes. And the translations, even of the ones with the best intentions, like Elizabeth Anscombe, which you probably have known here, are unfortunately rather misleading. I give you an example of a translation by Elizabeth. in Wittgenstein's so-called investigations, there is a key element, a key sentence, a key point in the book. The book begins with about 100 examples of model theories describing language and the function of language. And he shows for each of them, beginning with Augustinus, ending with his own from the Tractatus, that they do not work and why they do not work and how they do not work. And after these examples, he makes a kind of turning in his point of view. And he argues, but how is it? Can we negotiate stringency away from logic? Wouldn't logic fall apart if we do that? And he continues further and says, this is not the point. The point is that we have to turn our whole point of view around our actual need as the turning point. And Elizabeth translated this as, we have to turn around our whole examination. An examination is not the same thing as my point of view. An examination is comparing an established knowledge to a questionable one. But turning my point of view is not relating to any established knowledge or structure whatsoever. And these tiny mistakes lead to all sorts of strange misunderstandings. So, for instance, at the end of his Tractatus, Wittgenstein speaks he compares the sentences of his books, once they have been understood, as being nonsensical, after we have been through them, above them, etc. And out of this, and the unfortunate translation, namely translating nonsensical as nonsense, a whole theory of understanding Wittgenstein has developed. It runs under the name the New Wittgenstein. But that is based on a misunderstanding. They believe that Wittgenstein did actually write nonsense sentences. Wittgenstein did not write nonsense sentences. What he means by nonsensical is about this. If you are trying to knit a pullover, and your cat messes up your wool. If you want to continue knitting, you have to disentangle the wool, which is a complicated process, complicated work. It's necessary, otherwise you can't continue knitting. Once you have finished disentangling the wool, this complicated task has lost its meaning because now you can continue knitting. In that sense, he uses this term. It has nothing got to do with nonsense. So there are many, many examples that lead to serious misunderstandings through the translation.
That's a very good explanation. I've got two more questions I want to ask you. One is, it's a very large claim to make that you think he is one of, if not the greatest thinker, presumably in the field of philosophy, of the 20th century. Can you explain very simply why you think, or on what grounds you think he's so great? What is so amazing about him?
That's not easily answered, but I will have a go. Our world is determined by sciences. Sciences is based on what we call laws of nature, or laws. Now, such a thing like a law of nature does not exist. It would only be accessible to someone who could see the world from outside the world, and that's only given to a god, but not to men. So these laws are rules made out by men. And even if these rules have been made out in the best intention, by strictly following the rules and not caring about any other aspect, it can get seriously wrong. So a bit like when Edward Teller argued that the hydrogen bomb or the nuclear bomb is actually not a problem, is neither good nor evil, it has no moral implication, as they have come about by the strict application of science. Now, if you strictly apply something which is incomplete and possibly also misleading, you will end up in disaster. In that sense, you could compare Wittgenstein to a picture that Lessing produced in a short text called Educating Mankind. And he makes a comparison between an elementary book and being responsible for what you do. And he says the elementary book is a book which is necessary for the child that doesn't understand to tell the child what it should do and what it should not do. And in order to make the child to follow these rules, as the child doesn't understand its meaning, you supplement these rules with rewards and punishments. Now, this type of book is meaningful to a certain part of a person's life. But once the child has outgrown this, to keep the child with such a type of book will end up in disaster. And that is a bit, in my view, what science represents today. Because many of the problems we are having, well-meaning people like the Greens and the like say, oh, this is based or that is due to irresponsible politicians or industrialists, etc. That's true to a degree, but they do not describe the world and understand the world. They use the description of science. And you cannot easily say scientists are malicious. So there must be something else that is going wrong. And in that sense, you could say Wittgenstein's philosophy is a philosophy that has all the qualifications to move men away from the elementary book to the individual responsibility of each one in this world. A bit, you could say, resembling the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Now that is rather a daring comparison.
Mm. Well, Wittgenstein sounds more and more like Jesus, doesn't he, with all his apostles and disciples and new visions and new clarity and simplification.
Well, that's exactly how Lessing puts it. He said a better pedagogue had to come to take away the elementary school book from the child that had outgrown it. And then the sentence follows, Jesus came. So you have it.
And Wittgenstein arose. The other quick question, we can go back over these perhaps later, but the other one is, we were talking about the book called Wittgenstein's Poker, and the writers of the book spent some time with you, and then a lot of time with you, and then produced the book, and you said they left out a number of important observations which you'd made to them. I don't know if you can remember any of the criticisms you had of that book or feelings of what they'd left out.
Well, in my view, they left out the essential points. The essential point is that Wittgenstein wrote this book, which in English is called Tractatus, which unfortunately doesn't convey what the German title does. The German title is Logisch-Philosophische Abhandlung. Eine Abhandlung is a treatise that is a description under a precondition, a prejudgment. That's eine Abhandlung. And the prejudgment or precondition was the logical and the philosophical. Now, this book had initially an enormous impact in the German-speaking world, where it was circulated as a kind of, Wittgenstein called it, a pirated print. in a paper by a chemist called Wilhelm Ostwald, which was called Annalen der Naturphilosophie. And it in particular had an enormous impact in Vienna, in the so-called Vienna Circle. What is important in this context is, in Austria in particular, there were quite a number of important books, texts written with the criterion logical. It was Husserl, it was Carnap, it was Popper and Wittgenstein and many others. The important element or aspect of the logical in the Austrian scholarly writing was that it was aimed at breaking the education monopoly of the Catholic Church. So to replace the ideology of the Catholic Church by logic. That was the intention, the movement. But that was a serious misunderstanding for Wittgenstein's text. It was certainly true for Popper and for Carnap. At the same time, which is quite interesting, there was a movement fairly similar in England, but relating to the specific of the English society and culture, and that was basic English. That was an aim to break the education monopoly of the upper classes. And in Germany there was a movement which was even stranger, and that was that Germans felt, or the educated Germans felt, that German nationalism might turn into a problem. And as they saw German nationalism manifested in the German language, they invented these universal languages like Esperanto and the likes. It's quite fascinating. It all happened at the same time.
1930s?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. 2030s, yeah.
Mm. The bit I didn't understand was how the writers of the book on Wittgenstein's poker, what did they omit? What should they have said?
They had made no reference to the importance of logic, of the logical, of his first book, Die logisch-philosophische Abhandlung.
I see.
The second point is that they stressed the Jewishness of both Wittgenstein and Popper.
Yeah.
They both are of Jewish descent, but neither of them saw themselves as being Jewish. Wittgenstein actually was not aware of his Jewishness until the 30s. And Popper, even after the war, when he was asked to contribute to Jewish societies, etc., constantly refused. Only when he was asked to participate in a book on Freud, Einstein and Popper, he was very happy. So the Jewishness was certainly not an issue, not for those two people. Not that Jewishness is not an issue, but for those two people, it was not an issue. And if it was an issue, it was one of upper class and lower class. The Wittgenstein family belonged to the most upper class in Austria, and the Popper family came from a fallen middle class, and that never really creates a great deal of understanding and sympathy, but had nothing to do with Jewishness in the first instance. So they omitted that because that didn't really fit into the scheme. And in their research as to what really had happened, they were more interested in the aspects which are of journalistic interest than of what actually had happened. They reported quite truthfully the diverse memoirs of what had happened, namely that it is by no means clear that there was such an event. But they could have started off with a rather clear and factual statement, namely that the kind of poker that was used not only in these colleges but in all the Cambridge colleges, namely a piece of steel, could not be held at its handle when the tip of the poker was red hot. Not possible. So that certainly has not happened. The second thing is, they all went to the room. I went with them there. The room is so small, there were about 30 people. With 30 people in this tiny room, you simply could not have had a fire. They would have all suffocated in it. But the story was too good. And I have known Popper quite well, and we became relatively good friends in the end. In the beginning, he was fairly hostile, as I was admiring Wittgenstein. But in the end, he said to me, well, maybe this story about the poker, he might have not remembered correctly. And what I believe is that this story by Popper told the story, is what we call in German ein Treppenhauswitz, meaning it is a joke that springs to your mind after you have left the party.
Very nice. That's a very nice point on which to end. Thank you very much indeed.